Hello, this is Terrence McNally. After recording a conversation a few days ago with Alex Kasar on his new book, Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College, a couple of news stories caught my eye. In one, Gallup polling reveals that 3 in 5 Americans favor amending the Constitution to replace the Electoral College, marking a 6% increase since April 2019. Election by popular vote is favored by 89% of Democrats, 68% of independents, but only 23% of Republicans. No surprise there. 77% of them support keeping the current system in which the candidate with the most votes in the Electoral College wins. Okay, so that's a news story about how it stands with the public. The other story, far more ominous, led me to contact Alex again so we could deal with it in our interview. According to an article by Sam Levine in The Guardian of September 25th, Republicans are considering the possibility of asking state legislatures to ignore the will of the popular vote and to appoint electors favorable to the president. Quote, the push to appoint electors would be framed in terms of protecting the people's will, according to an unnamed Trump campaign legal advisor, adding, the state legislatures will say, all right, we've been given this constitutional power. We don't think the results of our own state are accurate. And we see that the Trump campaign is sowing doubt, you know, every day about that. So we don't think the results of our own state are accurate. Here's our slate of electors that we think properly reflect the results of our state. And though several Republicans deny the report, the chairman of the Pennsylvania Republican Party says on the record that he has discussed appointing loyal electors with the Trump campaign. Quote, it is one of the available legal options set forth in the Constitution, unquote. So, Alex Kasar, I found this about the most frightening thing I'd read from the Trump administration. Read it late at night and could not get to sleep. And there have been plenty of scary things, but this one really got me. Do they have the constitutional power to do this?
The answer, Terrence, is yes, they probably do. But it might depend on some of the details. This has been a scenario that has been keeping me up at night for about 6 months.
Okay.
And I have occasionally been talking about it, and until recently, I think some people thought that, you know, that I had gone off the deep end while plunging too heavily into research on the electoral.
Right, right. You've gone from being a serious scholar to an alarmist.
Right, exactly. The fact is that the Constitution reads, the wording of the Constitution, and actually I reproduced the text of the relevant passages of the Constitution and the 12th Amendment in my book, but it says, each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors. Okay, in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct. In fact, early on in our history, legislatures chose electors by themselves in quite a few states. South Carolina continued to do so into the 1850s.
Mm-hmm.
And we also know that at the time of the 2000 election, this was when this first really came home to me, the Florida legislature, which was Republican-dominated, was preparing to do the same thing if the outcome of the court cases had been different. So what we know is that a state legislature can do this, but here are some caveats and some qualifications. The state legislature can certainly do it before an election is held.
Mm-hmm.
There's really little question about that. In the wording of the Bush v. Gore decision, it was stated that the legislature could take back that right even after it had granted it to the people, but it was ambiguous about whether it could do it after an election had been held. So that's one area of dispute, is whether, you know, an election had been held and whether the state legislature retains the power. But the broader political point, and looking at the kind of something between messiness and catastrophic developments that could occur in November, is that Republican state legislatures and the Republicans dominate the state legislatures in 6 critical swingish states.
Right.
Okay. that they could at least make a claim that the count is so screwed up, there's so many ballots coming in, they're being challenged for fraud, you know, or for not being valid, that we can't tell what the actual popular vote really was. And in that circumstance, and in order to meet a deadline that is set of choosing electors by early in December, they are selecting electors by themselves. That is a plausible strategy for Republicans. Now, what would happen if they did that, or how they would go about do that, is going to depend on state laws and on court's interpretation of federal laws. For example, if a legislature wants to actually change its state law about how to select electors, will that require the agreement of the governor? Probably yes. Although they might argue that in this circumstance, no. And the governors of many of these states are Democrats.
Right. There are states that are battleground states that the Democrats were able to win the governorship, but not yet able to win the legislature, dominated often in most of those states by rural voters.
And by gerrymandering. I mean, for
example,
you know.
Of course, right. Where the popular vote may go 60% Democrat, and the legislature may show up 35% Democrat.
Right. That's a little extreme, but it illustrates the point. So one question is whether they were in a given state, whether they would be required to pass a new law or not. Another question has to do with who in the state is required to certify the electoral vote that is being sent on from the state to Washington, okay? And the details vary, and it could be the governor. In some places, I think it's not the governor. It might be the Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm offering a portrait of is I don't think it's obvious, although other scholars might see more clearly than I do, that we can take a state-by-state breakdown and say, aha, here's the path there, and there's the path someplace else. That's probably true, but it may be hard to anticipate in advance. What we are looking at, in all likelihood, if the Republicans should adopt this strategy, is the existence or creation of two different competing slates of electors from some of these states, which will be sent to Washington, and the legitimacy of those or the resolving that dispute will have to be determined by Congress. It's a recipe for a really advanced and complicated electoral crisis.
Right. And a couple of things I hear there are, one, that time may be on our side. Two, that certain states may decide that even though there's an inclination among some people to do it, it just looks like it runs counter to, you know, to they're not in session. They can't get the governor to call a special session. It seems to me time might be on our side in some circumstances. But my guess is that in some states, were they to choose to do this, given the legislature's Republican, given the governor's Republican, and so on, they could maybe really push it through. Now, then it becomes, as you're really saying, it becomes a bunch of legal questions. And that's where actually it dovetails with the death of Justice Ginsburg and the appointment and probable confirmation of the new justice by Trump and the Republican Senate, which would then be a 6-3 Republican-appointed advantage and might be decisive as it was in Bush v. Gore.
Well, that's absolutely a possibility. There's an intermediate messy step, too.
Good.
which, you know, these constitutional provisions were, you know, did not foresee a lot of potential problems. But the intermediate question is actually who in Congress counts the votes and certifies them or formalizes them. The phrasing in the Constitution is the President of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all the certificates, and the votes shall then be counted. It's passive voice, okay? The Republicans would insist that the power to count the vote would be in the hands of the President of the Senate, who would be Vice President Pence. Others would argue that, in fact, the count has to be agreed to by both branches of the legislature. This was a mess that arose in 1876, the famous crisis which terminated, among other things, in the end of Reconstruction as part of a major league political deal.
Right.
The legal guidance about how to proceed from there was provided in a piece of legislation which Congress knew after 1876 that it had to find out some way to resolve disputes of this sort. So it produced a piece of legislation called the Electoral Count Act. It took 11 years to produce this piece of legislation, and the legislation is largely incomprehensible to legal experts and everybody else. So, buy extra popcorn and hang on is all I can say about that.
Oh my God!
And then it would go to the Supreme Court, and then with a 6-3 Republican majority, and if that were to happen, of course, it would. It was strongly suggest that there was nothing about the conduct or decisions of the Supreme Court that was about legal nuance rather than about partisan brawling.
Right, right. And in other words, one could say, as people have said, that they thought that the Electoral College would finally be up for execution after the 2000 election went to the loser of the popular vote. That did not happen. One could also say that some certain things about the Supreme Court might have been front and center after the Bush v. Gore unprecedented decision, and even the wording in that decision that it not be held as precedent, that it was not only unprecedented, right, but they didn't want it to be a precedent for the future. But that didn't really happen either. And so we find ourselves where we are. And as you say, we don't know. And the sad thing is, this is not what we're talking about, Alex Kesar, a problem that's just a problem for academic scholars. This problem is real, and we are all, viewers and participants, and this is where we stand. Thank you very much for joining me again, Alex.
I can't quite say it's been a pleasure, Terrence.
Yes.
Since the subject matter is sufficiently disturbing, but yes, it's been good to have a chance to really talk about this, and I hope that your listeners will benefit from my attempts to clarify a very murky situation.
That's right. That even a good root canal is a good root canal. Okay. That's Alex Kesar, Harvard history professor and author of Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? And now you'll hear the interview I did last week with Alex Kesar. Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Alex Kesar, professor of history at Harvard and author of Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? To learn more, you can go to harvard.edu and search for Alex Kesar. Alex, A-L-E-X, Kesar, K-E-Y-S-S-A-R, K-E-Y-S-S-A-R. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn and airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. We're recording this Tuesday, September 22nd, and there are exactly 6 weeks until what has long been called Election Day, but this year, if you're thinking of voting by mail, with the post office now led by the Trump crony and hit hard by the loss of business mail, I think we'd be wise to give ourselves at least a 2-week margin So let's think about voting by October 20th. I encourage you to get involved not only with candidate campaigns, but also with efforts to fight voter suppression and assure that all Americans get their right to vote, all the more challenging in this time of pandemic. And as we confront the coronavirus pandemic, I encourage you also to do your part by social distancing, wearing a mask in public, and by finding ways to help those in your community hurt most by the social isolation or the economic devastation that now unfolds. Finally, as we continue to make our voices heard against racism and police brutality and for justice and inclusion, do your part to keep this campaign, this movement alive, whether it's showing up in the streets or just taking on the deep reflection or habit building in your personal life and with those closest to you. Now to today's conversation. The U.S. holds only one popular national vote, that for president and vice president. And the Republican Party has won that national vote only once since 1988. That's 32 years. Think about that. Yet they have held the presidency nearly 12 of those years, and currently also hold a majority in the Senate, though they've received millions fewer votes than the Democrats in Senate elections. And as a result of those two things, they dominate the Supreme Court. As Matthew Iglesias wrote on Vox.com yesterday, quote, control of the courts allows Republicans to further tilt the electoral playing field, and waging judicial politics on a tilted playing field allows Republicans to control the courts. Under the two most recent popular vote losers who won the presidency through the Electoral College, we've suffered the terror attacks of 9/11, the unending and unwinnable wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the Great Recession of 2008, and the failed response to the COVID-19 pandemic that has so far cost 200,000 American lives and left us a devastated economy. In addition to the Electoral College, Republicans used gerrymandering and voter suppression to thwart the will of the people. A couple of other examples of minority rule cited by Iglesias. The Senate map gives rural areas 2.5 times the voting power of big cities, meaning Democrats need to win Senate races by 6 to 7 points. In the 2018 midterms in Wisconsin, Democrats swept narrow victories in, so this is on the statewide basis, swept narrow victories in statewide races and secured 53% of the votes cast in elections for the lower house of the state legislature. But because of gerrymandering, the GOP won more than 60% of the seats. Knowing they'd be insulated from public backlash, the legislature held a special lame duck session during which they stripped power from the state executive, the one most closely elected by the popular vote, and reassigned that to themselves in the legislature. Something similar happened in Michigan that same year and in North Carolina 2 years earlier. Now, I believe that sustained minority rule not only produces unpopular policies, which makes very clear sense if you don't have to depend on the majority of people to win your elections or to get your political dominance, then you can do what you want, less fettered by the will of the people. But I believe a deeper issue is that it weakens and sickens democracy, breeding cynicism, resignation, and the sorts of tribal divisions we now face. And I'm certainly not the only one to warn that our democracy today is in deep trouble. And today we're going to deal with one of the engines of minority rule, the Electoral College. Alexander Kasar, the Matthew W. Sterling Jr. Professor of History and Social Policy at Harvard, has specialized in the exploration of historical problems with contemporary policy implications. His book, The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States, was named the best book in U.S. history by both the American Historical Association and the Historical Society, and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the LA Times Book Award. His latest book, the one we're going to be talking about today, is Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? Welcome, Alex Kasar, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Thank you, Terrence, and thank you very much for inviting me onto the show.
Yeah, and I will tell listeners that you and I are actually college classmates, although I don't know that we knew each other in college or have run into each other all that much in reunions. But our class during this pandemic has begun doing weekly Zoom calls, something which I think has actually brought people together in this time of isolation. I don't mean that call alone, but that sort of thing. And I heard about your book in one of those calls and immediately decided to invite you. And now, what's interesting, of course, is that I said then, okay, Electoral College, minority rule, this is close to my heart, let's set up an interview. The fact that it is just a few days after the passing of Justice Ginsburg, when the power, both the political power and the corrupting power of minority rule is now front and center in people's consciousness. So we're more timely than I would have liked.
Yes, no, I completely agree. I had a note from a journalist friend about a week ago saying, I just read your book. I liked it a lot. I hope it's not too relevant.
Yes. So, now, I like listeners to get a feel for the people that I'm talking to behind the work and the ideas. So briefly, how do you see your path to the work you do today? And you can go way back, mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
It's a very interesting question. I come from a ethnically mixed white family, but partly Jewish, partly Irish. And I think that when you come from when you have origins like that, it can make you curious about the past and how the past shaped you. And I had a very influential grandmother who had escaped from a variety of countries where she was oppressed pursued, starting in Russia, then to Germany, then to France, then to England. I mean, she escaped to England during World War II. I think that moving it, to a more conscious level, you and I came of age really in the 1960s. And I, as a teenager, and then even when I was in college, I became very alert to the civil rights movement, which I found deeply disturbing. I was from the North, but one could not miss it. And then there was the war in Vietnam. And the war in Vietnam was a shaping experience for me. And I became part of the anti-war movement. And I found myself asking a lot of different versions of the same question, which is, why does this country, which seems to be a good country and have good people and has treated me personally very well, why does our government keep doing such destructive things? How do we explain that? And that led me to a decision to study history, really between college and graduate school. Because I had taken almost no history courses in college.
Interesting.
And I had majored in literature, but I had taken a lot of other social sciences. But historical questions struck me as one way of really trying to understand the present. There's a quote, which I learned much later, from a French historian named Marc Bloch, who said that history was a way of knowing. And I think that captures what I felt intuitively about the study of history. So I went to graduate school, I studied history, and one of the things I realized was that there were dimensions of the American past which had been very much unexplored. I worked first in labor and working class history. And I was very interested in the social history of the working class, and I worked in that terrain for quite a long time. And then I got interested in political institutions and why sentiments that I saw out in the society, historical views, political views, weren't translating into political power. Mm-hmm. And that's what got me to the right to vote. And X years later, that took me right into the Electoral College.
Makes sense. Very, very good. It's interesting. You ask a historian, they can sort of tell you the history of how they got here.
Sorry if that went on too long.
No, not at all. No. I always feel actually that I usually start with a version of that question. So that, just as I said, so that I'm interviewing a person and the listeners are meeting a person and not a book, you know, or not a project.
Right.
And so, you know, no, that was fine. Let me ask you, How do you respond to what I said in the intro? Some of your thoughts on minority rule as a phenomenon, its dangers, it seems that when you hear folks talk about American exceptionalism, they ignore usually the fact that we have an old constitution, that no one has copied it exactly. And I think, you know, we are now dealing with some of the weaknesses, some of the loopholes, if you will, and so on. And I think that it's like a slow crisis with flare-ups, with specifics like this Supreme Court justice and the battle over that and other things. But that there's this slow erosion, I think, of people's belief in democracy is even a deeper and darker story.
Let me offer three comments about that, which come to mind as you were talking. The first is that we need to recognize that minority rule was something that was present almost every place for a lot of our history, and that it was present in the South of the United States, really, arguably until the end of the 1960s. So that there's a tradition of a gap between the operation of our institutions and the rhetoric. The traditional story, which contains some truth, is that the institutions changed over time to become more democratic and to become more compatible with the rhetoric. The second point I would make goes back to your, I think, a very insightful part of your introduction, which was about the dangers when minority rule starts having cyclical operation, i.e. you have a minority that is in power and is doing things which the majority might not want to do, but even more destructively, which then changes the rules so that it can remain in power. I mean, the whole, you know, the theory of democracy, in some sense, boiled down to its essence, is that if democracy works, it means that the people can change governments if it doesn't like what the government is doing.
Right, that's sort of the fallback. Yeah, we've got an issue here, there's a problem there, there's something there, maybe it's corruption, maybe it's this and that, but elections are where things get straightened out.
Exactly, and that's sort of the basic theory and is the fundament of our system. Well, when it becomes much more difficult for elections to serve that purpose, then the democratic content of what you have is extraordinary. I mean, your example. I guess from Wisconsin,
right,
about the legislative elections, and there's a very similar pattern in North Carolina, where in election after election recently, Democrats and Republicans have had roughly the same number of votes, a large majority of North Carolina's congressional seats are in the hands of Republicans, and its legislature is dominated by Republicans, so thanks to gerrymandering. In that instance, so I think it is a real danger. And then to move it forward one step towards the issues that have been up for the last few days, which is the courts. In some periods, in periods of democratic advances, it has been the role of the courts to put a limit on those actions by states that constrain democracy.
Mm-hmm.
That has been an important role of the courts really during the entire Warren Court era, because Warren Court's decisions on voting rights matter, including declaring that the Voting Rights Act was constitutional and a number of other measures, was to say that if you don't have an unbiased and democratically operating electoral system, that violates the Constitution, and thus we will prevent any state from passing laws that do that, passing a law that discriminates, for example. The courts in some sense have been a kind of backstop for that, or they were for a number of decades. But they haven't always been. They weren't always in the late 19th century or the 20th century. The courts, for example, I don't want to stray too far into the history, but the courts, for example, said that the all-white primary in southern states was okay. The Supreme Court said that that was okay. That was a way of keeping blacks from having any influence. And it was very tidy, because the premise there was that the Democratic Party was a private organization, and it could decide who could vote in its primaries, and the Democratic Party said only white people could vote. Of course, there was no Republican Party in the South in this period, so that meant that basically you had a completely undemocratic regime, and the courts approved that twice before finally in 1944 the Supreme Court said no, that's not constitutional. Well, moving back to the contemporary era, what we have been seeing, and this is alarming, is that the courts have increasingly taken contractionist rather than expansionist views of issues affecting the right to vote. These are nitty-gritty issues. These are not... it's not about outright disenfranchisement anymore. It's about voter suppression. But, for example, on state laws that limit the hours that polling places can be open, or when to send out absentee ballots, or how absentee ballots will be counted, or how many polling places there need to be, the current crop of conservative justices have come down in the interest of keeping the right to vote narrow rather than enlarging it. The most dramatic recent example, of course, was what happened in Florida a week or so ago, when the 11th Circuit Federal Court of Appeals basically supported a law by the Florida legislature which said that convicted felons had to pay all of their fines and fees in order to have their right to vote restored, even though the state of Florida could not tell many of these people how much they owed.
That's right. That was the real kicker. Yeah. And for people who don't know the background, and want to be reminded of the background of that, was that there are many states in which, or at least several states in which, felons do not have the right to vote even after they serve their sentence. And there was a ballot proposition in Florida, which won with an overwhelming majority, giving felons the right to vote once they'd served their sentence. And the Republican state legislature enacted this rule saying, well, it's not enough to serve your time. You also have to pay all these fees. And then, as you say, the federal appeals court just upheld that ruling.
It was an extraordinary decision.
And very close to an upcoming election.
Right. And although it might be appealed, or there might be further discussion of it, it effectively keeps out of the electorate, we don't know how many people, a million people are covered by the law. We don't know how many people will or will not be able to vote.
And as you say, the state cannot or has not shown itself able to even inform them of what this debt might be. And it's about as close to a poll tax as we've seen. I thought you were going to say the most egregious one being the 2013 decision in Shelby County versus Holder, which invalidated the preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act.
I mean, again, for your listeners, the preclearance provision was the provision which said that covered jurisdictions, a number of states and counties in other states, had to get approval from a federal district court in Washington or the Justice Department to make any changes to their voting procedures or processes or structures, and to get approval for their districting maps. And the Supreme Court, in an opinion written by the Chief Justice, said, well, times have changed. You know, we are no longer, this law was written in the 1960s, the conditions no longer apply, so the states that can be covered are, you know, we can't use the old coverage formula. So they declared the coverage formula to be unconstitutional, and without that, there is no operative preclearance provision. And this means that basic states in these areas have instituted stricter and stricter requirements for voting.
Yeah, within 3 hours of that Supreme Court decision, yes, Texas declared it would implement a law that had previously been turned back, and others have followed suit. You know, the thing that struck me about that was that that voting rights law and that preclearance provision applied only to a number of states, I forget, what, 5, 7, something like that, who had shown evidence of discrimination against African Americans. My thought was, rather than take it away, why not apply it to every state, you know? This isn't just a question of, although in the 60s it was most markedly people of color, it's a question of democracy, you know, no matter who you are. That before you can put in a change, it has to clear that this does not disenfranchise people.
That would be a perfectly coherent position, and it would have undercut the court's rationale. It would have created a lot of work for the Justice Department.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how happy they would have been about that, but it would be a coherent position.
Yeah, and I just want to quote that in doing a bit of research on that decision, I came across the famous quote from Ruth Bader Ginsburg in talking about getting rid of preclearance was like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet.
Right.
And I must share with you, Alex, a couple of weeks ago I was sitting in a park and some people came by. I was wearing my mask and one of them was not. And she said, well, I don't feel we need it. We're doing so well now. And I said to her, so when it's raining and you're using an umbrella, do you think you should take down the umbrella? So I think it applies to mask wearing as a very contemporary and relevant application.
Yeah, that's a very good point, right? Take off your masks because COVID levels are lower. Okay, now we'll see what happens.
So I assume that this book has grown out of things like the 2000 election and the 2016 election. And what most surprised you in your research for this book? Why do we still have the Electoral College?
Sure, it's a good question, and let me say something about the emergence of the question and the puzzle that motivated it. I mean, yes, the 2000 election was like somewhat of a kind of wake up call. I've never really thought much about the Electoral College. I began reading around what's out there. There is a vast literature out there saying Electoral College good, Electoral College bad. Most of the literature is Electoral College bad.
Right.
But there's a steady stream of books saying that the Electoral College is a good thing. And that terrain seemed to me to have been pretty well covered. Mm-hmm. You know, the arguments were there. I found the arguments in favor of getting rid of the Electoral College to be more persuasive. But there didn't seem to be anything new there. The puzzle started for me, I guess, in the aftermath of the 2000 election. Because you may remember, or you may not remember, but before the 2000 election, it was conventional wisdom that if we ever had a wrong winner, with the person who won the popular vote not becoming president, and that hadn't happened since 1888 at that point, if it ever happened again, that we would get rid of the Electoral College. That was bipartisan conventional wisdom. But it didn't happen.
So what's interesting about that, of course, is we could afford one such mistake, but that we'd be wise enough not to do it again. What's interesting is that they didn't prevent it, but one should push us in the right direction.
That was the thinking in the 1990s, say. There's a prior history, which let me allude to and then we'll return to later, which is that there had been a very strenuous and almost successful effort to get rid of the Electoral College in the late 1960s and 1970, which almost succeeded. It came very, very close to succeeding. But let's return to that episode
a bit
later. But so, you know, the question formed in my mind, well, why aren't we getting rid of the Electoral College? So then I began to, poke around a little bit. I wouldn't even say it was research. It was just exploring. And several remarkable facts came to light. One was that there had been an enormous number of efforts to seriously alter or replace the Electoral College. I mean, large numbers, as in something between 800 and 1,000 constitutional amendments have been introduced into Congress. On no subject have there been more proposed amendments. And they date back to about 1800. So a long trail of discontent and efforts to deal with it. Second fact I learned was that since 1944, which is when we first get reliable public opinion polls, a majority of the American people, and often a very large majority, have wanted to get rid of the Electoral College. So you have this institution that does not conform to American values, or to democratic values. I mean, it's not one person, one vote. It's not all votes counting equally. That has been unpopular with the American people for as long as we have clear evidence about that. And where politicians, political leaders have been trying to get rid of it as well. So that really is what gave shape to the question of why do we still have it? Why have there been so many attempts, many of them led by very prominent political leaders, and why have none of them really gotten through?
Mm-hmm. And as you say, and I think if people kind of didn't kind of notice when you said that, but roughly 900 constitutional amendments have been introduced to alter or abolish the Electoral College. That's a lot. And on six occasions, you point out, amendment resolutions have been approved by one House of Congress.
And approved by the requisite two-thirds vote.
Yeah.
For a constitutional amendment.
Yeah. Let me tell people that you're listening to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Alex Kasar. He's professor of history at Harvard and author of Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? And to learn more, you can go to harvard.edu and search for Alex Kasar. Alex, A-L-E-X, Kasar, K-E-Y-S-S-A-R, K-E-Y-S-S-A-R. And one thing that I like, not all times when you go to a college kind of website and look, or university website, do you see, they really do show most of your articles, most of your interviews, and so on. People can find them at those links. So briefly, how did the Electoral College happen? And I'm going to read actually something, a quote to set you up, which is, it was a long, hot summer in Philadelphia. Everybody was tired. And at the end of the summer, the convention went on vacation for a week. They left a small set of knotty, unresolved issues to a committee, the Committee on Unfinished Parts. And it is that committee which comes up with the design of the Electoral College, which with modifications is then adopted by the entire convention.
That's the basic story. I mean, to fill in a little bit on that story, when the framers arrived in Philadelphia in the beginning of the summer of 1787, they just didn't know how to choose the chief executive. There were a lot of stuff that they were confident that they were confident about, but this was not one. The default position, to use 21st century language for a gathering in the 18th century, the default position was that Congress should choose the president. And when they did kind of straw votes several times, that was always the position that had the most support. But they would, they, you know, they would do that, and then they would say, you know, that's not a good idea. Then there's no real separation of powers. The potential for corruption is very great. So let's not do that. And then they would go off onto other subjects, and they had a lot of complicated questions. They'd return to this issue periodically. They discussed having a national popular vote. And among others, James Madison actually favored that, although he thought it would disadvantage his native South for a while. But he it did not have a whole lot of support, partly because Southerners didn't want to do it because with a national popular vote, they would get no credit for their slaves. But also people thought that the country was too dispersed, too thinly populated. People would not really know who the candidates were. I mean, these are plausible arguments. I mean, you have to pick, you know, picture this country of 3.5 million people stretching, you know, along the Atlantic seaboard and somewhat inland. They discussed having governors choose the president, and they discussed having various other kinds of electors. Anyway, so they go around and around, and then it gets to the end of the summer, and you know, it's summer in Philadelphia can be pretty hot. And this was pre air conditioning, so most of the convention goes on vacation, and the committee comes up with this idea, and I think that the appeal of what they came up with, and we have to also remember it had several different parts, but the appeal of what they came up with was that, in a sense, the Electoral College, if you look at it in total, is a replica of Congress.
Exactly, you know, exactly. But just to point out, when you were saying, when they thought, you know, when they kept coming back to, well, maybe Congress should do it, what they realized was they were at that same time not only trying to come up with a chief executive, but trying to come up with these three branches and the checks and balances. And they could see that if Congress elected the executive, that there goes your checks and balances, there goes your separation of powers. And this way, they use the same formula they use for Congress, only these people do not exist once they cast their vote.
Right, very well said. And there could be no problem of corruption, you know, or of non-separation of powers, because the electors have gone home.
Yeah.
And the other thing which the Electoral College did was it avoided reopening questions about the slaves and not slaves, whether slaves should be represented or not, and some of the things about small states and large states, because by it had already decided, it being the convention, had already decided early in the summer that what the representation in Congress would be, and effectively it imported that into the presidential selection system.
That's the three-fifths rule?
Well, it imports the three-fifths rule, but by just saying you have the same number of electoral votes as you have members of Congress.
Oh, right.
And since they had already decided that for seats in Congress, it would be according to your entire free population and three-fifths of your not unfree population. So they basically don't reopen that issue.
Right, right. I see. Yes, exactly. Once they've set that as the way you elect your members of Congress, then your apportionment now remains the same in the Electoral College, so that three-fifths rule is implicit in it.
Right. But the other thing I want to mention is a part of the Electoral College which we rarely think of today, although it is still in the Constitution and came close to being called into use even in the 20th century. This was the balance between large states and small states. It was not the small states were given protection not by being given a little bit of extra electoral vote power, but by the second half of the process. The presidential election system, and by the way, the term Electoral College was never used.
Right. It's not in the Constitution.
It's not in the Constitution. In the 19th century, it was usually used in the plural, electoral colleges, mm-hmm. meaning the gatherings in each state. It became a shorthand for the whole system only in the 20th century. But there's two possible steps to it. One is what we think of as the electoral college, votes are cast in the states and da-da-da. But the Constitution also says that to become president, you have to win a majority of all electoral votes. It's not whoever gets the most votes. You have to win a majority. And if you don't get a majority, then the election reverts to the House of Representatives, where in which every state would get one vote, meaning the smallest states would have the same power as the largest states. That was the protection for the small states, particularly since, and again, picture these people writing in 1787, 1790, they had no conception of political parties.
Right.
We may think that a two-party system and elections with two candidates are the norm, but they didn't.
Right. No, I think it's very fascinating for people just when, if you want to do a thought experiment, is to, actually remember that when they were designing this system and writing this document, they were not considering parties, which now I would say, is as singular and significant a fact of our political life as anything.
Absolutely.
And yet they designed this system without considering them.
Oh, absolutely. And the fact is, in that respect, the Electoral College was obsolete by 1800.
Right.
Because by then there were parties.
Yeah. Oh, one thing, by the way, when I was thinking about that provision, which is that the decision goes to the House of Representatives, but in a most unrepresentative fashion.
Right. Exactly.
When you take it to one, each House, whether it's in Wyoming or California, each House delegation gets one vote. You see that it makes the Electoral College look good.
Right. It also had another problem which showed up on the couple of occasions when this was used, which is that if a delegation from a state was evenly divided, then they cast no vote.
Oh, no kidding.
How do they decide? I can only
imagine the political swapping, the political game playing that goes on at that point. For the good of our state,
right?
We've got to, one of these two, somebody's got to get a majority of votes, and what kind of backroom dealing goes on to do that?
And although we think of this mechanism in the House, which is called the contingent election process, we may think of it as something extremely rare, and it's been rare.
But it was used twice. 1800 and 1824, right?
Yes, and many of the framers thought that it would be used very frequently.
Oh, right.
They thought that this might be the norm. There wasn't a clear consensus on this, but they thought that this might be the norm. The notion was that, you might have 3, 4, 5 candidates for president.
Yeah, once you get rid of parties, then this notion of only two candidates, that's not a given.
Absolutely. So, the whole system was designed for a different political universe.
Yeah.
And in fact, they had to modify the one successful amendment that has been made to the Electoral College was the 12th Amendment, passed in 1804, which corrected another a deficiency that arose when parties formed, which was that in the original design, every elector cast two votes for president. And the candidate who won the most votes became president. The candidate who won the second most votes became vice president, even if they weren't running on a ticket. That's
right.
How it occurred that in 1796, John Adams, who was a Federalist, became president and Jefferson became vice president.
Right.
So the 12th Amendment ended up correcting that problem by saying that electors voted, sort of designated their ballots for president and vice president.
Right. Right, right. And as you point out, despite the fact there have been 900 constitutional amendments introduced in Congress to make a change, very little has changed since then. Now, I think we can use one of the things you just said to get us to the next step, which is that this 1796 election set us up for the 1800 election, in which this is where winner-take-all is introduced.
Yes. I mean, it had begun to be introduced in some states, in a couple of states, but the real key moment is 1800. And backing up a little bit, what the Constitution did, and it's a compromise with the states, it's a gesture towards state power. It spells out how many electors each state gets. That's a constitutional mandate. But it leaves it to the states to decide how those electors will be chosen. It does not mandate winner take all. In fact, from what we can tell, the most common thing that the framers imagined was that electors would be chosen in districts within each state. There would be district elections. And in the 1790s, there was a lot of experimenting with different kinds of districting. But it also left open the possibility that the state legislature could choose electors by itself. And that, in fact, did happen in these decades. Indeed, it happened. That's what South Carolina did well into the 1850s. So what you had was a kind of, and what happens in 1800, the key move to winner-take-all, although the conflict over this spread out over the next 20 or 30 years. But in 1800, as noted earlier, Adams had become president in 1796 with Jefferson as vice president. Adams had, in fact, gotten one or two electoral votes from Virginia. And the Democratic Republicans in Virginia, as they approached the 1800 election, which was a rerun, didn't want that to happen again. So they junked the district system and moved to winner-take-all so that Jefferson would get all of Virginia's electoral votes. Shockingly, Massachusetts, where Adams was from, retaliated and did essentially the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of kicks off a bandwagon, which then goes up and down and all around for about another 20 to 30 years until winner-take-all is instituted in all states by the 1830s.
Right, and just so people realize, that is a key thing, just as much as we think of the Electoral College as, you know, giving the advantage to small states and so on. That winner-take-all disenfranchises voters within each state.
Right.
Right? In other words, if California, with its millions and millions of votes, goes, 51-49, those 49 millions and millions of voters have basically no say. And that's what winner-take-all does. Let's talk about one of the strains of this, which is we've talked about the three-fifths of a person, and then what you point out is that the end of slavery only increased the advantage for white Southerners.
That's right. It's something which which is somewhat lost to view, which is that after the Civil War and after several constitutional amendments, African Americans are formally enfranchised in the South. And thus the representation of Southern states in Congress and in presidential elections is based on the entire population, a five-fifths clause, if you will, all whites and all blacks. And that's completely reasonable for about 15 years until African Americans are disenfranchised again, state by state in the South by the 1890s. And what that means is that white Southerners, they now have the full complement of electoral votes, but only whites are voting, so that they have a significant extra increment of influence in presidential elections that stems from their African-American populations that are not enfranchised. And this becomes a reason why the Southern states become and remain arch opponents of any proposal that would eliminate the Electoral College and replace it with a national popular vote. If you have a national popular vote, the influence of your state depends on the number of votes that are cast, period. If under the Electoral College, the influence of your state depends on the size of the state population, no matter how few people vote. So there is, in effect, no penalty for voter suppression under the Electoral College as there would be in a national popular vote.
Just in case anyone doesn't know, we've talked about it a couple of times, that three-fifths of a person. I'll say my understanding of it and then correct me if I don't do it quite right. But what That's they fine. Did was, it's one of the great compromises of the Constitution, to get the South, which was a more agrarian, and where a huge, or at least a significant portion of the population were slaves, they said, okay, each slave owner gets their own vote, plus they get three-fifths of another vote for every slave they own. So if you own, five slaves, you get two votes, your own vote plus that other vote. And that basically was true until the Civil War. So the slaves were counted, but they didn't vote. Then after slavery is undone and African Americans are enfranchised, for a while those Southern states now have blacks and whites voting. The whites in those Southern states then create laws that strictly keep blacks from voting. But because the Electoral College, as you said, is based on population, not voters, they get credit for those non-voting blacks. And as you point out, while that may have changed, the Voting Rights Act changed to a great extent explicit outlawing of black voters, there's no penalty because of that, the fact that the Electoral College is based on population, not voters, to voter suppression, voter ID laws, intimidation, closing polling places. We've done two or three shows probably within the last year and a half on the various methods of voter suppression. But because of that quirk, what it also did, as you point out, is it one of the things you've said you discovered in your research as perhaps the biggest reason why we still have the Electoral College is white supremacy.
Yes. No. I mean, to be precise, I think that's the largest reason why we don't have a national popular vote. Okay, which we tend to think of as the reform. But there were a lot of other proposals for district elections or proportional elections, and these tended to be blocked for other reasons separate from issues of white supremacy.
So let me ask you this. Still true today?
I think the way this operates today, and I certainly think it does have, it has echoes and overtones of race. I think there are two things going on today. One, at the level of state political parties, any state which feels that, or a party in a state which thinks that it has a reliable majority in elections, tends to favor winner take all, and in fact that is the pattern, very common pattern in the South, where the vast majority of whites vote Republican and the vast majority of African Americans vote Democratic. So in that sense, the pattern does carry over. In the current world, though, in addition to that, or going beyond that and including that, is that the Republican Party effectively decided in the 1980s that the Electoral College benefits it and its candidates. And they have clung to this conviction. And that's in contrast. I mean, we have to point out, in the 1960s and early 1970s, mm-hmm. when there was a very strong bipartisan movement to get rid of it, it was Republicans as well as Democrats. The leadership of the Republican Party favored having a national popular vote. Richard Nixon favored having a national popular vote, tepid as it was, but Gerald Ford, Bob Dole, many leading Republican members of Congress in the 60s and 70s took this position.
You know, I must say, this whole voter suppression as a key to preservation, I recall when the Supreme Court stopped the recount in Florida, Bush v. Gore, and so handed the presidency to Bush, the image that hit me right then was, here we were, we're entering a new century, we're entering a new millennium, but the Republicans were not going to let the future take power. And I saw this image of a corpse rising out of the grave and saying, not so fast. And ever since then, I think we've seen that as you look around and you say, well, we might not win it on policies, we might not win it on, you know, this or that, but if we can gerrymander, if we can suppress the vote, voter ID laws, if we can do all of these things, like we've talked about in Wisconsin, in North Carolina, that is our method of holding power. And of course, lifetime appointments to the courts by people who were elected by a minority, as you pointed out very early in the conversation, kind of does this ripple effect of one minority rule leads to another and another.
Right. And the Electoral College clearly contributes to this. I mean, this is, you know, and the commitment to it as a mechanism for preserving minority rule has been increasingly evident. Obviously, I've written a book. I'm out, you know, writing op-eds and speaking about this. So I pick up the noise, the flack, so to speak. Conservatives have been writing, and actually there's a new propaganda film defending the Electoral College. They clearly, with this very weak old arguments, there's nothing very new in it except a few slightly dishonest new wrinkles. But they are actively out engaged in a, you could call it a public relations or a propaganda campaign.
Right, rehabilitation campaign for the reputation
of the Electoral College. So they clearly see it as that the Electoral College is one of the key instruments, one of the key mechanisms in their arsenal for remaining in power.
Okay, so pretty much the final question, Alex Kesar. What do we do? And here would be the point to talk about the National Compact for a national popular vote.
Yeah, I mean, there are, broadly speaking, two different approaches to how to deal with this. The one which has dominated thinking for a lot of the last 15 or 20 years is, how do we get around the Electoral College or get rid of the Electoral College without doing a constitutional amendment? There have been a lot of ideas floating around about this. The one that has gained most traction is the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which is complicated. And I won't explain it right here, but if you want to, we can get into it. It is a mechanism that commits states to cast their electoral votes for the winner of the national popular vote. It has already had support from 15 states in the District of Columbia, and whether or not support will build after this election is unclear. It's been, to my mind, an ingenious organizing tool. If it were ever implemented, it would produce an enormous number of lawsuits, mm-hmm. and I fear would also be unstable over time.
Mm-hmm. And let me just say that one detail you left out is the way it works is that when states with electoral votes of 270, which is the amount needed to elect a president in the Electoral College, when states whose votes add up to 270 each have voted within their state to say that their state will go along with the national vote regardless of their state's popular vote, that then it would kick in. And so that's and I think we're at 196 right now, and who knows?
No, that's right. That's right. I mean, I think that, but I think that some of the complications related to that have also led people to think again about a constitutional amendment, which would more durably and securely change the system, but is harder to get to. And that becomes thinkable, I think, only in, well, in a couple of changed electoral circumstances. One is if the Democrats gain more power in Congress. But I think that, you know, it's a very dangerous thing to have one party impose a new electoral system on another party. But I think that the chances for change will hinge on, or change in the near run or the middle run will hinge on what happens to the Republican Party in this election, both in presidential and other contests. I mean, if, for example, Texas were to go for Biden, or Georgia were to go for Biden, and both of those things are possible.
Right.
Then winner-take-all might start looking a little less attractive to Republicans.
Right, right. If there are close elections in, and I think you could add Georgia, and we've already, I mean, the Republicans have counted on Arizona for years, and it looks like Arizona will likely go Democratic this year. But if Arizona, Texas, Georgia, Florida, a lot of population and growing population goes, if you were the Republican Party and you lost those state elections 51-49, you'd say, I want that 49% to count.
Right. And the Republicans also been, you know, I mean, you know, they've been convinced that the Electoral College advantages them, but they put out a, you know, it's a quirky system, too. And politics is a change, is business of change. You know, the Republicans forget that in 2004, when George Bush won the popular vote, he came very close to losing the election in the Electoral College. Ohio, a switch of 60,000 votes in Ohio would have given Ohio to Kerry and thus the presidential election.
And yet that 60,000 votes would not have given Kerry the popular vote. So, yeah,
no,
we could
absolutely
have had 2000 go one way and 2004 go the other. We got to bring it to a close. So, again, the book is Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? To learn more, go to harvard.edu and search for Alex Kaysar, K-E-Y-S-S-A-R. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 or 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts and at most major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts there or at my site. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNallyTerrence. Thanks to G in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. Most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And thank you, Alex Kaysar. Keep up your good work.
Thank you, Terrence.
Okay.
It's been a pleasure.